Welcome to NACSW's Podcast of the Month. Our podcast program makes available recordings of a wide variety of NACSW presentations and discussions on topics of particular interest to Christians in social work. Our Podcast of the Month program features a new podcast every 30 days for your listening pleasure. We hope you enjoy today's podcast.
My name is Jerry Streets. I'm the senior pastor of the Dixwell Congregational Church in New Haven, the oldest African-American congregational church in the known world, as the church likes to say, will be 200 years old in 2020. I'm also a clinical social worker. And a member of NACSW. Evidence-based research shows, study results indicate, more research is needed. We are familiar with these phrases as social workers, social work educators, and researchers. The quest to ground in advanced social work theory and practice is derived from practical experience, insights about human behavior, our relationship with one another and our environment, and from scientifically revealed knowledge. There has often been a debate about which methods and sources of knowledge that supports human flourishing are privileged to validate social work practices. Religion and spirituality as areas of study in the social sciences and in the practice of social work and psychology has been met by some in the academy and helping professions with caution, if not skepticism. Our guest speaker is significantly helping to overcome the fear of examining religion and spirituality as attributes of understanding people as whole human beings. Research in cognitive behavior and neuroscience and child development is benefiting the knowledge foundation and practice of social work. The implications of Dr. Miller's work in these areas are advancing a reapproachment between science and religion and spirituality as valuing one another. Our pursuit to reduce suffering and support human thriving is enhanced by Dr. Miller's work. I am grateful to have had the opportunity to witness her spirit of gratitude and work as a presenter in my class on spirituality and social work practice I teach in the spring at Columbia University, and as a visiting guest faculty facilitator in the Spirituality Mind-Body Institute of Teachers College, Columbia University, of which she is the founder. Members and guests of this NACSW annual conference, it is my pleasure to present to you one whose evidence-based scientific research study results shows that while more research is needed, religion and spirituality is a part of the nature of things inanimate and human, Dr. Lisa Miller.
Very generous welcome, Reverend Dr. Streets, your treasured colleague and friend. Thank you for including me in this most wonderful coming together. When I started out as a clinical scientist in 1997, there was not one single scientific article on spirituality or religion in recovery, in the portrait of human triumph and struggle, in mental health and wellness, in the first two decades of life, so children and adolescents were not understood as spiritual beings. And yet I can see plain as day, as we all can, that those children who came through times of struggle and difficulty with a close personal relationship to God, no matter what word they may use, God, Allah, Hashem, whatever word was their traditional family word, had an entirely different course of recovery. And I'll share with you a story of a young girl. She was 13 years old. I'll call her Ileana, who came to see us in the clinic. This was a big city hospital. Ileana found her way 20 city blocks to a big, scary hospital building up to the 8th floor, and there she sat all alone. And I couldn't believe it. Most children had come with a grandparent or a parent. But Ileana sat four. Shut this off here. A little better? No? How's that?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll go this way. So here was this little girl all by herself, and I said, please come in, talk to me, what brought you here? And she went on to tell me that her greatest love was her father. Her father ran a small grocery store up in Washington Heights, and one night two men who he knew were drunk. They came in, robbed him, and murdered him. And that had been the end of her world. He was her sun, her moon, her stars. And her life then shifted as she went to live with her mom and grandma, who, as survivors of enormous abuse and torture, had become very walled off. And her life became very walled off. She barricaded herself in her room. She wasn't allowed out to visit with friends. And she would make murals cut from magazines of young girls and young boys who she thought looked really nice and maybe she would want to be friends with. But in this world of isolation, as she came now to treatment, she was simply not getting better through the standard way that we did treatment, a very standard, secular way that was silent on issues of deep connection to God, that was silent on any deeply spiritual understanding of her father. Until one day, Ileana came in with a certain joy that I hadn't seen over months. She had a little hop to her skip. You're not going to believe this. You're not going to believe this. Guess what? My brother's sister's aunt chaperoned me. I went to a party, and there I met the nicest boy. He was so polite. He was so courteous. And we spoke for 20 minutes. And guess what his name was? His name was Horatio, the same as my father. Don't you see? Don't you see? My father sent him. My father's looking out after me. And once Ileana had shared this deep understanding, not a belief, a knowing, that her father walked with her, her recovery began. She came out of the trenches and rejoined the living. Now, had I spoken to her in the way I'd been trained, which was to nod respectfully that that was her belief, it would have deflated the entire sense of connection to the sacred. It would have been iatrogenic harm, which, as you know, in hospital language is when you come in with a broken bone and you leave with polio, much sicker. Iatrogenic harm. So a mental health field silent on the spiritual truth made no sense to me. And I set then to work in 97, as have in time many labs around the country. And I'm sharing with you today 20 years of very good peer review science that is directly relevant to our care and our contribution to the healing of people like Ileana, people who have a deep personal awareness of the sacred in their lives. And that is not a belief, it is the reality through which true recovery can begin. So what do we now know? Well,
let's start here. We know these are the four major big findings from science. They are of total relevance to our work. Every child on earth is born a spiritual child. We have inborn in us a capacity for deep connection to the sacred. And again, what we call that may change from our faith tradition, our culture, but we are born with the capacity to turn to God for guidance. And in fact, that is indeed how this has been measured by many labs around the country. I turn to God for guidance in times of difficulty. When I have a tough decision to make, I ask, what really does God want me to do? Nature is a sacred home to me. That capacity, if we look through the lens of science, a twin study, turns out by the time we're adults to be one-third innate, but two-thirds cultivated, two-thirds in the hands of what I might call the ambassadors, our parents, our grandparents, our teachers, our clergy. All those people who embrace our development are instrumental to shaping this natural birthright for spiritual life. Now, science cannot hold up a lens and measure spirituality, but science can hold up a lens and look at the extraordinary impact of spiritual life in the human journey. And that is what this body of work does. It says, how might life look different when we realize this innate capacity, our birthright, to feel close to the sacred, to know, not simply believe, but feel and be in living relationship with the sacred. Second point, with adolescence, literally coming of age, puberty, there's a surge in this capacity marked by a 50% increase in the innate contribution, the genetic versus the environment. And we see this in our teens, a hunger to feel closer to God, a questioning, a desire to know the truth. And teens, as we are well aware, are exquisitely good at sensing the truth and equally good at sensing the untruth or the hypocrisy. The teen, in many sense, is better at this than any of us in any other decade of life. The deep passion to know, the exquisite sensitivity to the sacred. And yet the teen can often be ignored in this great gift. Every tradition on earth marks coming of age. Confirmation, Bar Bat Mitzvah, the Anipi, the Sweat Lodge. Puberty goes hand in hand with a greater spiritual awareness. And this is, again, part of our birthright. Innate, hardwired, a biological clock. When we support this, remember the two-thirds of the formation that comes from us. There's nothing in the clinical or social sciences now 20 years later as profoundly important to recovery, as enormously protective against the onset of depression, anxiety, substance abuse. Science has looked at everything under the sun, from medications to divorce, to environment, and there's nothing that matters as much as a deep spiritual core. Now, this is you. No one can take your place. There's no pill. There's no treatment center. There's nothing more important than that deep connection with you as a spiritual ambassador. How important? Well, American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, a teen who's intensely spiritually oriented compared to one who doesn't know what you mean by that, is 80% less likely to become addicted. 80% less likely to become addicted. When you look through the lens of science and see something so hugely impactful, you wonder, as a scientist, if what you're looking at in substance abuse is sometimes a foreclosure of spiritual hunger. It is, as some teens have said to us in our research, the tricky back door that doesn't really have legs under it. 60% less likely to have major depression. Now, every teen will get depressed. There's a developmental process, as we know, of becoming a teenager that involves a struggle, an existential struggle. But a deep major depression is far less likely when there is cultivated a spiritual response to loss, to disappointment, to the inevitable derailings. 70% less likely to have dangerous or unwanted relations. A girl who knows herself and feels herself as a sacred being is far less likely to in social, normal social situations, end up where she doesn't want to be. So this is not a small matter. This is essential to the formation of who we are in the second decade. And in fact, science now tells us that when we do support our teens and our children in their deep spiritual formation, it is a setup for life. How we graduate high school at 18 with 90% likelihood tells us where we'll be at 26 and then later at 38 in our capacity to feel the sacred presence, to say, I turn to God for guidance in times of difficulty. And we know other things too. By 26, I'm now less likely to use creepy drugs like Ritalin. I'm more likely to have made relationships of commitment. And I'm more likely to have joined a faith community if when I was 18 years old, I left home with that deep connection. Life looks different on the outside, and life looks different on the inside. These are brains. Normally, in an MRI study, we're incredibly excited and publish a tiny little speck of difference between one group and another. These huge areas of red are areas that represent processing power, cortical thickness, to develop in people with a strong spiritual life over time. Again, what tradition may change, but that deep personal spiritual connection to their higher power is associated with a spiritual response in times of suffering, which over time means there's a stronger, better brain, effectively, for processing difficult times as well as good times. And where is the brain stronger? It's stronger in regions of perception and reflection. I can sit in the same chair, in the same house, with the same folks, my family, my friends, and the way it looks is bigger and more full of possibility, and it is a more sacred reality when I've cultivated my faculties of perception, my spiritual brain. This is all of ours, but the choice to develop it is in our hands and is deeply affected by our response to difficult times, which falls squarely in the power of your hands, together with what we'd call either the greatest presence, some call it the first presence, but our help, right? Now, let's look briefly at the upside. Grit, persistence, optimism, forgiveness, the good things in life. It turns out that all of these terrific character strengths and virtues don't necessarily sort evenly amongst kids. So I'll invite you for a moment to think of a young person you know who's full of resilience, a really resilient young person. And consider now a young person who's very optimistic and one who's forgiving. How many people were you thinking of? One. And indeed, that's what we see over large numbers of people. The blue young, there are 6,000 college students. The blue folks are high in everything, and the red folks, who we love just as much, are low in everything. The character strengths and virtues do not sort independently. They go hand in hand. So we might better understand them as character strengths of virtue. And sure enough, for the blue line, the green line, and the red line, 85% of young people, the extent to which I'm high, medium, or low actually is rooted in, on the far left, daily spiritual awareness. The capacity to see into the sacred presence in daily life. So the work of life becomes very different when we build the spiritual core. Here's life with a spiritual core and life without much support for the spiritual core as I go through the hard work of adolescence. Who am I? What's the purpose of life? What's the nature of life? Well, who am I from the view of no spiritual core? I am a great tennis player, a terrific football player, a super math student. Actually, I'm not very good at math or tennis or football. I am my parts, pieces, and accomplishments. But from the view of the spiritual core, that is much greater than anything I have or don't have, far more than anything I've done or not done, who am I? I'm a child of God. I'm made of life itself. So what is it to be good at tennis or good at math or not good at tennis or not good at math? Those are traits and endowments that are gifts. Gifts through which to carve out my contribution, my purpose, my meaning. And that means that the day that it doesn't all go so well, I'm just not quite so fragile. What is it to have failed at math today? Well, that was noise on the larger trajectory of my purpose and calling, my contribution. It's not a sum total of who I am. And this capacity for spiritual individuation, the coming of age with puberty, involves a real deep dive into the me and not me. Everything you ever told me, Mom and Dad, how does that square with now my inner heart? Everything you ever taught me about, say, spiritual life, what do I think of that now? And we hear in teens lots of doubt and questioning at times, for others a deepening of faith, but no one gets off easy. There's deep work with this surge, this natural surge that cannot be avoided in adolescence, to know the truth, to dig for the truth, and to live in deep alignment, a life of meaning and purpose and sacred contribution. We are built to want this, and without it, we are spinning and reeling. 80% more likely to become addicted, 60% more likely to become depressed. And this, again, is an area of enormous contribution in your hands. We looked around the world in India, China, and in the US, and we said, okay, we know that spiritual capacity is innate. The embrace of culture and tradition changes. But if we have this innate capacity, shouldn't there be some deep commonalities all around the world across all faith traditions? And indeed, we found that all around the world, there's a deep awareness of our foundational interconnectedness. Yes, you have your story and the person next to you has theirs, and yet there's a deep common ground of life we share, a sacred ground. Love is not just an emotion. It is different than happiness. It's a transformative, powerful force, love, a sacred force. Everyone gets this, India, China, the US. Service, prayer and action, tikkun olam, is a sacred act. A practice of connection, prayer, meditation, mind, body. And my life, finally, has a moral code all around the world that I didn't cherry pick, but it is derived from my deep understanding of ultimate reality, my higher power. These five expressions of natural spirituality, phenotypes, if you will, all around the world are stronger, when they're stronger, are protective against depression. All around the world, when they're stronger, are protective against substance abuse. And yet, in India and China, the more years of formal education I have, the stronger my five spiritual phenotypes, the more spiritually aware I am. Uniquely, in our country, are years of formal education derailing and foreclosing of my natural spiritual awareness. There is something in our mainstream education system that educates us out of our birthright, and I call it the tidal wave of despair. The antidote, of course, is you. The embodiment of spiritual life, sharing a deep connection, passing the torch of spiritual values. This is awakening of the birthright. We don't teach spirituality, we support its great presence. It's already there. We knew from day one how we were going to tell him the story. We were going to tell him the story of how he'd come to us as the miracle we knew it to be. So we said, Isaiah. Mommy prayed for Isaiah. Daddy prayed for Isaiah. Grandma and Grandpa prayed for Isaiah. Everybody prayed for Isaiah. And then we took, remember, 18 months, a train to a plane to an automobile, and we ran up the hill, and there was Isaiah. And we'd throw him in the air. We'd say, we found Isaiah. And it was the story of finding Isaiah. He loved this story until he was about 4. And the trains and the planes fell off, as they do. And the story that he started to love the most, as we lived in nature, way out in the country by a river, was the story of who comes down the river? Isaiah You are our baby Moses. And he loved that. I say, you've come down the river. I am baby Moses. And that story held until he was about 8. And then, as you know from if your parents or grandparents, nieces, nephews are in your life, driving along, everything happens in the back seat. Mama, Max says, his best friend, you are not my mama. My name is not Isaiah, and I am not Jewish. And I said, Isaiah, don't you remember? And he said, oh. And he whipped around and he looked at Max and said, I'm baby Moses. Max said, what? He said, I'm baby Moses. Max said, what? He said, never mind. Because Max simply didn't understand. And then, Mama, and this time there was more of an edge. Mama, Max says, what about the woman who gave me up? Now, from the view of psychology with no spirituality, there's not much success there. So I took a breath. Oh, from the back. I know. God whispered in her ear and said that you were crying for me. The child's a knower. The child is born a knower. And when we have the opportunity to tell life as we know it to be true, the child learns to see life and tell it as he or she knows to be true. So what are these natural capacities? I shared with you Isaiah's story. Every child is born a knower. We know from science that a child is born with a natural compass. She or he knows right from wrong. Now, it might be hard to follow that. It may be very tempting otherwise. But there's very little surprise about what's truly good and truly harmful. We know that children love prayer. Children love ceremony. They love to sing. They love holy stories. Children are born joyful and enthusiastic for sacred practice. Children are in genuine relationship with all living beings. I'll share another story of Isaiah. He was about 18 months. We're in the park, and he had found some peers who were little yellow fluffy geese. And he wanted to play with little yellow fluffy geese, which was terrifying to Mother Goose. So Mother Goose turned around and with a huge whip said, 180. That huge turnaround was away from Isaiah. It was to me. What was she saying? That's right. Watch your child. Exactly. So we would never turn around and hiss at a 2-year-old. We'd say, who's watching this child? Everyone is in relationship in the natural world, and the child joins in this deep relationship. When we support their natural awareness, they can maintain a deep relationship with all creation. But what I might want to avoid doing is saying, oh, Isaiah, that little yellow goose, he just wants your breadcrumbs. Right? That's an instrumental relationship. The child knows they're making friends. Family is sacred. Prayer community is sacred. Your school classroom is sacred. Groups have meaning. So your child may come home and say, not everyone was there today in school. Jonathan was not there today. Apparently he's not feeling well. I will confess, there are many days where I go through work for 8 hours and I don't know who's not there today. But the child knows what's whole and who's missing. Everyone counts, and there's a meaning in the wholeness. Children comfortably engage life and death. One last Isaiah story. I have 3 kids, but Isaiah's the oldest, so I wasn't tired yet. These stories come to mind more easily. We're sitting graveside at this funeral. It's the funeral of our beloved great-grandfather, Pop-Pop. And in the Jewish tradition, when someone dies, you sit graveside and literally shovel earth onto the casket so that you know in your body that they've passed. So there we all are, and the adults take a full-size shovel, and Isaiah, being very young, took a little spade, a garden spade. And when he put the earth on Pop-Pop's casket, he said, "Look, the body goes back to the good earth. The soul goes to God." He was telling us. And I said, "Yes," which is all the ambassador needs to say is, "Wow." 2 weeks go by. We're out in the backyard. "Mama, come here now." So, of course, we do. "Mama, look." And he points this time to a turkey who's passed, a dead turkey. "See, Mama? The body goes back to the good earth. The soul goes to God." His eyes sparkled. His eyes sparkled. He'd come into a truth. So death had not been traumatizing. It had been a doorway of spiritual growth and learning and awakening. Every parent, grandparent, therapist, social worker knows that every child is unique, and yet it is worth our consideration that death need not be viewed necessarily alone as traumatizing, but as a spiritual opening. Children we know have dreams and mystical experiences more often than not. It is absolutely part of the experience that we all share as human beings, but certainly in childhood. When we simply bear witness, we tell the child this is important, this is a gift, this is real. For many years, I was on the governing committee of the APA, and a fellow who was 20 years senior, an expert in grief actually, pulled me aside at one of our governing meetings, and I mean way aside, and he said, "I want to tell you something." He said, "I've never told anyone this, but I was married for many years, and my wife, we adored each other, and she became very sick, and I mean it was awful. She had cancer, she got sicker, and when she died, I was a wreck. In fact, I was so depressed that my friends worried about me, and they had me move into their basement. And there I sat, day after day, and time wore on, and I wasn't any better, and my friends were very worried, and I didn't know if my life mattered anymore." I said, "But then one night, she came to me. She came. I saw her presence. She came closer and closer. I felt her great love. I felt the love as I'd always felt her love. And then she came into me. And then I started to recover." He said, "I've never told anyone that story." I said, "When did that happen?" 30 years ago. It was the most important experience of my life. When we give people permission to share the most important experience of their life, then all that that opens and all that that carries becomes available to deep integration, deep opening of their spiritual path. A child is a quick study, and research shows that when we simply join into the spiritual awareness, listen to the questions, ask questions, pray out loud, the child hears us and knows it is real, knows that this is how life is built and this is what we talk about. A study done showed that when a child was responded to for asking a spiritual question, within 1 week they increased the number of spiritual questions they asked by 50%. In 1 week, for having been seen and heard as a spiritual being. So we are enormously important, and there's tools that we already have built into our lives as spiritual and religiously observant people. But it's worth highlighting that research has plucked these out as real leverage points. A sacred language, a name for the higher power, a name for the presence in and through us. When we give things words, the child can focus and see it. All day long, tow truck, apple, banana. When we name the spiritual reality, that map of reality comes into resolution for the child. When we pray side by side with children, or meditate, or whatever our family practice may be, it is more than simply teaching the practice. It is shared in that passing of the torch so that the child knows just when and where and how and the truth of the significance of our sacred practice. There's a woman I know who for many years watched her father meditate. She'd go up, watch him. He'd say, "You're welcome to sit by my side." She said, "No thanks." And after many years of this, finally, her last year in high school, joined him. 2 years later, she's off at college. She hits the developmental depression we can count on and has a response. She has a spiritual response. It was the response that her father had taught her. When we pray before a meal, when we pray before bed, when we pray coming and going over glorious moments of gratitude, the child learns that this is a way of seeing into life. And it is, in fact, our transparency that is above all other contributions, our transparency into our own spiritual life, the greatest teaching for the child. Last story. This is not about Isaiah. It's about Isaiah's grandfather, my father. When I was about 9, my father's mother passed. I remember this well. My mother was a very expressive, devout, religious woman. And my father was quiet and not so expressive. And it wasn't always so clear what he thought or felt. But this time it was. He woke up the day after the passing of his very own mother. I was up, as usual, at 5 a.m. And there we sat, my dad and I. And he said, "You know, I had a dream last night. Grandma Ellie was in my dream." And normally Grandma Ellie loved to dress up. She loved to dress up in beautiful clothes and wear jewelry. But in this dream, Grandma Ellie was in a very everyday gray suit. And there we were walking down Grand Avenue in Des Moines, Iowa, where he'd grown up, side by side, Grandma and I. And my father said, "It occurred to me that Grandma had always been my mother and walked with me. She would always be my mother and walk with me." It was very, very raw in the way I tell it now. There was no clarity of its ultimate theology or meaning or direction. It was very direct. It was pure transparency. And because he was so generous, when I think of my father, this is the register of our relationship I think of. And when I think of my ancestors, I know to this day, because my father told me his dream, that our ancestors walk with us. I've since collected 20 years of data that tell me most people on earth know this to be true too. But I know it to be true because my father shared his dream when I was 9. And this is our gift of transparency. In The Spiritual Child, there's a great number of references, but I'll share just one last point, which is spiritual multilingualism is a gift. And spiritual multilingualism means that we in our family, we have our faith tradition, and the Joneses or the Lees or the Rabinowitzes down the street, they have their faith tradition. But I can do more than just sort of nod respectfully and acknowledge that. There's the possibility that in the deep heart, I can feel what the Joneses and the Lees and the Rabinowitzes are all talking about when we talk about the renewal of spring, whether it's Easter or Passover. I can know what everyone is talking about when we feel the deep spiritual meaning of the arrival of a new child. So to be spiritually multilingual is to find the words in 3 traditions, 4 traditions that hold this universal spiritual truth. We can model this, and we can sit with someone from any faith tradition and be spiritually multilingual by having a client-centered point of view, a child-centered point of view. I don't need to be expert in every tradition on earth to show up and open my spiritual heart and share in this deep, foundational, innate capacity for spiritual life with utter respect and interest. A child-centered, a client-centered point of view means that two people of deep spiritual heart can join together in a treatment, in a prevention, in a teaching, and share foundational common bedrock. So these are our gifts. And when we pave the road for our young people in the first two decades, it is there the rest of our lives. And this is you, of ultimate importance and of ultimate significance. Thank you.
Can you tell we really like students? So I have good news, students. So the cool news is Lisa has copies of her book. Very generously, all of our students, just our students, David, don't pretend to be a student. All of our students get free copies. So you can, there's a table right out in the exhibit area, right by where the posters are when we get dismissed. But David, for those of us that are not students, there's also a really deep discount for the rest of you, and so there are copies there that you can get for $10. That's a pretty good deal. So if you want to know more. And now we get to invite Vanessa. Vanessa, you got one more song in you.
Allison, okay. Before we do that, Lisa was open to doing a little bit of question and answer.
That was not in the script.
But we're just kidding.
So maybe you could invite Lisa back up. I'll set up a mic in the center aisle, and we can ask anyone who's interested in asking Lisa a question. You can have the mic right here. So first questionnaire, please come on down. And others who have questions can just line up right behind.
I'm wondering if you have seen children for whom that innate spirituality became somewhat distorted or through religious experiences or through a family experience that actually ended up being pretty traumatic in terms within a religious framework.
So whether within or without of a religious framework, the great undoer of religious life is when the messenger doesn't live the message. And the more egregious that difference, the more serious the confusion. So when the words don't match the deeds, it can be very confusing. And when that's severely, the words don't match the deeds, it can lead to the baby being thrown out with the bathwater, so that there's a loss of personal connection for the time being. A loss of personal connection to the higher power, and that can heal, right? That can heal, and there is, as we know, enormous power in post-traumatic spiritual growth. In fact, the science says that if you look at someone to recover from trauma through the hard work, not the skippy overnight, but the hard work of post-traumatic spiritual growth, they actually end up doing better in the long run than someone who never faced trauma but never had deep spiritual development. So in the long run, the level of depression and anxiety is lower in people to survive and deepen over time their spiritual core than people who have never faced severe hardship but have not had built that deep bearing. And that's been shown over a range of different forms of trauma. I'll share with you one more story. There's a fellow I know about 12 years ago, maybe 10 years ago, I was speaking to a group in Utah, and in the very, very, very back row, there was a man and his wife who just sparkled. They glowed with love. I mean, I couldn't take my eyes off them. in the back row. And in fact, I was so taken by them that when the talk was over, I invited them to my host's home for lunch. They were absolutely full of love. And I wanted to know, how do you work? What do you do? Who are you? And he went on to share, his name was Dr. Gary Weaver and his wife Colleen Weaver. And the Weavers had worked for 30 years working with young people, the last 10 plus of which they'd spent working with court-referred boys. Now, the specific court-referred boys were boys who'd been terribly abused and had now become abusers, so that not many people wanted to work with them. But Gary Weaver did. And in fact, when a boy went the third time before a judge and was going to be sentenced to prison as a minor, Gary Weaver was the alternative. The judge would say, you go to prison or you go with Weaver out to the desert. And Gary Weaver took these boys out to the desert where he would help them reconnect to the sacred. He'd help them reconnect to God. Now, they didn't want to hear, many of these boys, the language of their family's tradition, because the messengers were foibled human beings who not walked in keeping with the message. But through reawakening their direct spiritual awareness, they in time actually did start speaking in the language of their family tradition. Gary Weaver found some boys who simply had nowhere to return to. And when that happened, what he chose to do was adopt the boy. So when I met him, he had adopted 28 boys. And his wife had carried one, which made 29 sons. So these boys would tell stories like this. They'd say, you know, as a child, I couldn't step in my house. I couldn't step in my house. There was so much rage. There was so much violence. So I would get on my bike and I'd ride around and around and around and around again the block. And then every so often, I'd hear this house that was full of laughter. And I'd stop my bike and I'd stand outside this house and I'd just listen to the laughter and the joy. And I felt like I was part of it. And I never dreamed that someday I would be adopted into that house. So that was the story of Gary Weaver. He, some years later, passed, and I went out to his funeral with one of my children. In his faith community, there were so many people in attendance, hundreds of people, that they had to open up the back wall of the church, and people stood in the backyard just to be part of the funeral. Up front, very moving to this day, were the pallbearers. 28 plus the woman, the boy he carried, 29 now men. 29 men as pallbearers. Everyone was included, everyone's a pallbearer. Those were his last wishes. And these were now men, men of contribution. They were teachers, they were park rangers, they were fathers. He is the testament, in my eyes, of what's possible when we work from a foundationally spiritual core. Yes?
Hi. So if a child who experienced maladaptive schemas leading to, obviously, maladaptive emotions, how would you incorporate spirituality into that child's life?
That is a very meaningful question, and there's two different ways I've seen it done. One is to offer other ways of thinking that have spiritual roots, right? And sometimes that is drawn from sacred texts, and sometimes that's drawn from the language of life. That's one way. So it's sort of a CBT model, because you're using the CBT frame of a spiritual response. The other way I've seen it done is to say that the way out is a spiritual way out, and that the schemas will reshuffle around that. So if I can reopen my connection to God, if I can start to feel a sense of connection with you as my therapist that is filled with a sacred presence, if I can start to experience and perceive life through the red brain, right, then I will, with your help, naturally start to tell a different story. Spiritual response to suffering. I failed, I'm such a loser, it always happens to me, I'm just not good enough, to, well, this is just a bump in the road. You know, there's much more in life than this test, right? And in fact, sometimes when a door closes, it means that I need to shift and look to find the door that's opening. And actually, I'm not alone and I'm not a loser. I'm a child of God, and I'm valuable, and I'm finding my path. You know, so it's just endless, the shift in schema that can come from a reawakening, with this, really the cognitions being pretty secondary when my heart is reopened. That's another point of view on that.
Thank you for joining us today for NACSW's Podcast of the Month featured selection. We hope you found today's session useful and that it will support your efforts to thoughtfully integrate Christian faith and social work practice. We also hope that you will consider participating in additional NACSW's activities and events, including NACSW's upcoming convention in the fall, our quarterly audio conference workshops that we offer at no cost to NACSW members, and which includes free CEUs accredited by the Association of Social Work Boards, our online continuing education program, and access to dozens of archived podcasts from the members section of our website. Also, we invite you to join NACSW's Facebook group or our Facebook fan page. For additional information about these and other NACSW benefits and services, you can go to our website at www.nacsw.org. Thanks again for listening in today to our podcast session today.